History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hello, everyone. This is an epilogue to our series on travelers and explorers, and we're going to look at what it means to be a traveler and explorer in the 21st century when so many of the conditions that the characters in this series lived in have fundamentally changed. When we have GPS, when almost every square inch of the planet has been mapped out. And it gets to the question of what's the purpose of going on a dangerous journey in the 21st century? Many people do. Now, it's in a very different form than someone in the Middle Ages or the 19th century, but it still happens. So what's the purpose for people to explore when so much of the globe has been surveyed, mapped, photographed, filmed, and cataloged? What can be gained from undertaking a dangerous expedition when little or no new information can be obtained, and Google Earth can give you instantaneous photos and video feeds? Well, what's interesting is that with no new places to visit, many travel writers have tried to solve this problem by following in the footsteps of famous travelers. Everyone can go almost anywhere, unless you're restricted by visa reasons, so mimicking a famous historical figure's travels has become a popular subgenre of travel literature in the last two decades. Many of the characters in this book have had their voyages recreated. In the late 1990s, two friends from Queens, Dennis Bilyeu and Francis O'Donnell, trekked 2 years across the 22 countries on Marco Polo's itinerary, all the different Central Asian nations and others. They went by foot, boat, camel, and donkey cart, as well as with armed escorts on the Afghanistan leg of the journey. In 2004, Tim Cope followed in the steps of Genghis Khan and his soldiers, traveling 6,000 miles by horse across the Eurasian steppe. Not to be outdone, explorer Tim Jarvis and his crew set out on Shackleton's exact route across the Antarctic in 2013, down to his 800-mile journey from Elephant Island to South Georgia in a replica 22-foot lifeboat. They navigated with sextants and nautical almanacs and traded in their Gore-Tex coats for vintage 1916-style parkas to get as much of the sense of the journey as possible. They also reenacted his 3-day-long hike across heavily glaciated mountains to reach the whaling station of Stromness, so it's like a Civil War reenactment. A similar mimicry of Captain Cook's journey happened in 2001 when volunteers and specialists sailed with 16 permanent crew on a replica of Endurance. They ate the same horrendous food that made up the original crew's rations and slept below deck, and they were crammed into close quarters to escape the tropical heat. Even Ibn Battuta has seen his journeys reenacted. While nobody has attempted to completely recreate and walk the extent of his multi-decade 25,000-mile journey, his travels are the subject of its own video game. In 2011, a Saudi Arabian game developer released the multi-platform game Unearthed, Trail of Ibn Battuta, a Tomb Raider-esque adventure in which the player retraces the famous pilgrim steps. Each of these replica journeys has been the subject of books, documentaries, and History Channel specials, and they've attracted great interest from history aficionados and amateur explorers. But do these adventures have any value when they're only reenacting original feats of bravery? It's sort of the question of what's the purpose of reenacting battles that have happened in the past. Do they add to our knowledge and inspire us? Is there something that we gain if we sort of do a martial arts form of something that someone in the past has done and we somehow understand them better because we've walked in their shoes? Maybe this is the wrong way to ask a question. George Mallory, who attempted to summit Mount Everest in the 1920s and disappeared at the top of the mountain in possibly the first successful attempt to reach the summit, and we're not quite sure one way or another, didn't believe the purpose of exploration to be geographical discovery or gaining scientific knowledge. Rather, the purpose was for the explorer to discover something about himself. When asked why he wanted to climb Mount Everest when such a quest appeared to be foolhardy and a death sentence, here's how he answered. The first question you will ask, which I must try to answer, is this. What is the use of climbing Mount Everest? And my answer at once must be, it is no use. There is not the slightest prospect of any gain whatsoever. Oh, we may learn a little about the behavior of the human body at high altitudes, and possibly medical men may turn our observation to some account for the purpose of aviation. But otherwise, nothing will come of it. We shall not bring back a single bit of gold or silver, not a gem, nor any coal or iron. We shall not find a single foot of earth that can be planted with crops to raise food. It's no use. So if you cannot understand that there is something in man which responds to the challenge of this mountain and goes out to meet it, then the struggle is the struggle of life itself upward, and forever upward, then you won't see why we go. What we get from this adventure is just sheer joy. And joy is, after all, the end of life. We do not live to eat and make money. We eat and make money to be able to live. That is what life means and what life is for. So as we saw at the beginning of this series with the example of the modern-day Arctic explorer Ben Saunders, who is retracing Scott's adventures in Antarctica, the reason for exploration in the 21st century is much different than they were centuries ago, but the lessons they teach the individual explorer are quite similar. Saunders said as much when he spoke of his 1,800-mile trek from the coast of Antarctica to the South Pole and back, which he completed on February 7, 2014. He and a companion completed the longest polar journey on foot in history to reach a milestone, but also in remembrance of the men who went before them in the 1912 Terra Nova expedition, in which Scott and the four men under his command all died after reaching the South Pole. It's for this reason that they named their journey the Scott Expedition. And it's through Scott's endurance that Saunders and his travel companion were able to continue moving forward. At times, we found ourselves in dire straits in the intense cold, wind, and altitude of the high plateau, weakened by half rations and closer to the brink of survival than I had ever anticipated this journey taking us, what Saunders said in a February 2014 interview. Both my travel companion and I felt a combination of awe and profound respect for the endurance, tenacity, and fortitude of Captain Scott and his team a century ago. The icy continent took its toll on the two explorers. In their 105-mile journey, in which each hauled a 400-pound sled of food and supplies, Saunders lost 45 pounds and his travel companion Tarka, 55, despite eating 6,000 calories per day of energy foods and freeze-dried meals to give them the strength to walk 17 miles each day. Frostbite always loomed, licking its chops at their vulnerable limbs and digits. Both suffered hypothermia. When their stores ran low, they began eating half rations, causing their stomachs to growl permanently and the ribs to grow more prominent by the day. They almost fell into stories-deep crevasses while crossing the Beardmore Glacier. Ferocious headwinds propelled them and their sleds along the icy surface, giving them little control. The biggest challenge they faced on the expedition, though, was the mental strain. Saunders and Tarka knew they were walking directly in the path of an expedition team where every member had fought with ferocious courage to survive, but still failed and died. Self-doubt and fear filled them whenever they were physically weak. In the final days, the weather pounded them without ceasing, never giving them an easy day. The continent seemed to be alive, determining to finish them off. They ended their journey by sliding to the Scott base, spotting familiar landmarks, unemotional and utterly exhausted. It was through this experience that they shared a bond with the explorers of previous centuries. Saunders was an avid reader of Scott's account in the Arctic and admired his firm resolve of a British gentleman to avoid incessant complaining. The ill-fated expedition leader maintained a chipper tone in his writings. When Shackleton and Scott were on an earlier expedition together, Shackleton wrote that, on the brink of complete exhaustion and starvation, well, I can't really complain. It's a fine outdoor life. Saunders and Tarka repeated that to themselves in the most miserable moments. Saunders resolved not to make his blog a litany of complaints about the brutal conditions, but rather to show that mankind can achieve incredible feats against the odds. But one bond that the two travelers didn't share with the older explorers was the benefit of knowing exactly where they were and being able to radio for help at a moment's notice. On day 70, their supplies ran so dangerously low that Saunders had to call in for a food drop, even though it changed the unassisted status of their expedition. Ski planes could assist them at a moment's notice. They were also able to keep in constant contact with the outside world. He was able to blog about his journey, email his family, and even send out high-resolution film and images due to his Intel-powered Sony Ultrabook and Iridium Pilot satellite system, which were powered by solar panels and lithium-ion batteries. Facing down terrible conditions and pushing oneself to the limit of physical endurance is only half the challenge of exploration, as Saunders and other people in the series have shown us. The other half is stepping into the complete unknown, a challenge that modern explorers don't share with their predecessors. The fear of what lurked beyond the edge of the known world haunted the imagination of the pre-modern world. It's for this reason that sea monsters adorn the edges of medieval and Renaissance maps. The images invoked a terrible death by monstrous creatures to anyone who ventured too far. Serpents were wrapped around ships, whales with beastly heads bored into the sides of vessels with their tusks and large teeth. Giant lobsters plucked sailors from the decks, cutting them in half or dragging them down to the watery depths. But oddly enough, these drawings inspire travelers to go on dangerous expeditions to confirm the existence of these creatures. Marco Polo sailed along the coastlines of Asia and Africa, fully expecting to see a sea dog or a sea pig. He had likely read Pliny the Elder's Natural History, which claimed that every land animal had its equivalent in the ocean. Why not spot fish resembling a known land animal? The fear of encountering such terrible creatures dissipated in the 17th century, as they also disappeared from maps when the ocean became a commercial zone and route for international travel and not this black hole of information. Expeditions across the Pacific dispelled the myths of these creatures. Printing presses made the spread of accurate maps and naval charts easier. Speculation and Greek myths were replaced with science. The study of marine life taught sailors that whales leapt out of the water to breathe oxygen, not to attack. Whales themselves became storehouses of valuable commodities like blubber and lamp oil and something to be hunted for profit, to be harvested, not something that could potentially lead to your death. But despite our increased knowledge, not everything is known and understood in the 21st century. While Earth's land surface is well mapped, this only covers 1/4 of the globe's total surface. Much of the rest is ocean, and it's every bit as mysterious as the New World was to Magellan. Enormous creatures live at the bottom of the sea, and they look every bit as ferocious as a creature on a 13th century Florentine naval map. One such creature is the giant squid, which was only first captured on film in 2013. It inhabits the depths of the ocean, where terrible pressures would kill most other life forms. Its cousin, the colossal squid, can grow to lengths of 40 feet and can descend to depths of 7,200 feet. Each tentacle is equipped with sharp hooks. Its beak slices up prey's flesh. In order to see in the darkness, its eye grows to a foot in size to capture every ray of light. Its pupils are nearly as large as an orange. The megamouth shark was only recorded last year as well. It's a rare species that can grow to 18 feet in length. As its name would suggest, it has a massive maw that can stretch to 4 feet in length. A diver would easily be swallowed by the creature, which mostly lives in shallow water. So the ocean is still a source of considerable mystery, and as such, explorers have undertaken many expeditions to uncover its secrets. In March 2012, director James Cameron, who directed Terminator and, fittingly, The Abyss, manned a vertical torpedo sub to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. He was the first human to reach the 6.8-mile-deep Challenger Deep. Here, Cameron collected data, specimens, and soil samples from the most alien realm on Earth. He spent hours exploring the barren seafloor, gliding along the Challenger Deep's cliff walls, filming the entire time. The descent to the bottom took 2 hours and 36 minutes. His trip, though, was more than a gimmick or a publicity stunt, even though he conspicuously completed the dive a few days before the release of Titanic 3D. Cameron's trip was a manned descent to the Hadal Zone, the deepest level of the ocean, located below 20,000 feet. This represents a shift in human deep-sea exploration to the region, which had been dominated by remotely operated vehicles. With a human in the cockpit, all natural human intuition descends into the depths as well, something impossible in a remote operated vehicle. Team member Patricia Fryer told National Geographic that this element is critical. To be able to turn your head and look around to see what the relationships are between organisms in a community and to see how they're behaving, to turn off all the lights and just sit there and watch and not frighten the animals so they behave normally. Even makers of remote operated vehicles agree that the human element is critical in discovery. Andy Bowen, a project manager of a probe that explored Challenger Deep in 2009, said that manned missions capture public attention in ways that a robotic exploration never could. And it's the same thing with space as well, where robotic probes to Mars, while still getting plenty of attention from space enthusiasts, don't get nearly as much media attention as manned launches to the International Space Station or elsewhere. Machines can't be easily anthropomorphized. They can't generate interest in the way an explorer can. This is critical for future missions because scientists need public support for the continuation of deep-sea research projects and space exploration projects. So, of all the explorations of the planet that have taken place in the last 800 years, humans are still finding new and startling discoveries. We're still uncovering vast swaths of unknown territory. And it's still a truism that it takes a human to do it. Despite automated technology, and despite drones, despite probes able to capture video and eliminate the risk of death, nothing will likely ever replace human intuition and instinct for discovery. It's the danger of death, the thrill of achievement, and celebration of expanding humanity's horizon that will always trigger some sort of desire to seek out the unknown. And to get back to the initial point of why explorers still risk danger in the 21st century, we learn something of ourselves in the process. To quote T.S. Eliot, he said, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." All right, well, that's all for this series. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. That is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to help support the show, there are some easy ways to do it. First of all, please like and subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice, because this helps the show grow. Second, you can get show notes, subscribe to the newsletter for History Unplugged, and also other great podcasts that are part of the Parthenon Podcast Network, including Key Battles of American History and Beyond the Big Screen, at parthenonpodcast.com. Third, you can join the History Unplugged membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. This includes such illustrious people as Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Dan Carlson, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, Willie from New Jersey, and Kristen Lee. You can join at three levels. At the first level, you get ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of History Unplugged, which is more than 500 episodes now. If you join at the second level, you get bonus episodes that come out about once every 2 weeks, and they include series on Audie Murphy, Americans Who Fought for the French Foreign Legion, and Teddy Roosevelt's Time in the Badlands. At the third level, you get all those things, including a shout-out at the end of each episode, a three-pack of great history books, and a personal request for me to do an entire episode on the topic of your choice. To find out how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, which is the name of George Washington's spy group, but also the membership program of History Unplugged, go to patreon.com/unplugged. Again, thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.